Do you love making movies as hard and you want to listen to more episodes?
Jump over to our Patreon page at patreon.com/MMIH and you can listen to the entire back catalog of episodes for just $1.99 a month.
That's an additional 300 episodes that aren't on iTunes that you can listen to whenever you please.
But without any more blibber blabber, back to the show!
You know, making movies is hard.
Making movies is hard.
Welcome. This is the podcast about the struggle of being an independent filmmaker. I'm Mark Bissell, the founding host of the podcast, and I'm a sci-fi horror filmmaker. And my first feature film, The Alternate, is out now on digital, DVD, and Tubi.
I'm Liz Manischel. I'm a writer, director, producer, who's made two features, Bread and Butter and Speed of Life. And I'm currently making more, including my horror comedy with Amy Taylor, Best Friends Forever. I'm a distribution consultant who does sales, and I used to manage Sundance's Creative Distribution Initiative. This week, we welcome cinematographer Checo Varse to talk about his work on the new Amazon show, Daisy Jones and the Six, as well as his work on Pacific Rim, It Chapter 2, and many others. After that, we play another round of The Game. But first, Ulrich, what's going on with you?
Well, lots of things, I guess. Lots of thoughts, at least. I did have another meeting about my movie that I've been talking about for weeks upon weeks and weeks. And yeah, it's still alive. It won't die, which is great. I love it that it's like still got energy and potential. And now we're meeting with a production company, which I won't name. Yay. To talk about maybe partnering. So like we would now, instead of being on our own, we would partner with them. They have a relationship with a really big agency. And so then we would like have this agency, you know, inside baseball stuff going on and help. And, you know, they also have some track to funding potentially. So like it would be like we would basically combine our approaches. So like that there would be some money there and also a connection to talent, and maybe it would just make this whole thing a little easier. So fingers crossed that it all works out well. I'm not a part. They cut me out of this meeting, which I'm totally fine because it's like a more of a business meeting. So it's just going to be the producers and then the other production company producers meeting, which I think is great. But yeah, so that's that. I had some thoughts, you know, about my life as a director just in the last 24 hours. Kind of like we talked to a filmmaker, Emily Apt, yesterday, which was a really great conversation. And, you know, she's a filmmaker who's made two narrative features now and like four documentary features. And she has two kids that are now like, you know, whatever, teen, pre-teenage. And she was talking about how it like gets easier and like, you know, how, you know, she has like a support from her family, but that, you know, also you have to be used to like not having money as an independent filmmaker, which is like, of course, something I know very well. And then, you know, we talked to Checo, you know, who's going to the interview for this episode. And you weren't on this one, Liz, but like he was literally in the car on the way to set being driven by a PA, having worked till like 2 a.m., 3 a.m. going overtime on the show and then going to his call time and like drinking his second coffee, like trying to eat his breakfast, talking to us. And then he's going to have another coffee waiting for him from his, you know, assistant camera operator or his camera PA. And then he's like going to do his job. And then, you know, his wife's a director and then they have a kid. And so they like, he was talking about how they like, they go from movie to movie and like, it's a circus and it's the best when like he gets to shoot while she's directing. And like, that's the wonderful thing. And I was just thinking like, man, that sounds hard. That sounds tough. It's like, and like he is living my dream in a way. Like, I mean, not to be a DP or anything, but like, you know, he's worked on Pacific Rim. He worked on It Chapter 2. He's worked on humongous studio features. He's done some of the best shows that we've ever heard of. True Blood, you know, this new show, like tons of other stuff. It's like, this is the level that I aspire to be at one day. And it sounds crazy difficult. So part of me is like, wait, do I really want that? Or do I really want to just make my movies over 14 years if it takes that long while I raise my children and be a happy, you know, dad with a job and whatever. And then like, I just get to make a movie every once in a while. Like, does that sound better? Maybe. Or do I want to work on It Chapter 4 and have a crazy life? Like, I don't know. Like, what do I want? I don't know what I want. I feel like it's like hard to even... It's like, you know, like in a lot of ways, like if you want to reach that level, you have to be so laser focused and like so like, you know, precise in your plan with your career. But in another way, it's like, I just don't even care. Like, I just want to make movies and I want to also be with my daughter and, you know, my son who's about to be born and like that is like what's more important to me. So it's like, well, all this rushing and hoopla and whatever, it's like, you know, maybe just step back from it and just like, you know, do it more in a slow, steady fashion and enjoy life. Maybe that's better. I don't know. So these are all ideas mulling in my head, you know, and like, kind of like we talked about this, like probably a couple of years ago, like reconfiguring your dream. It's like, I think like I'm constantly in a state of like questioning, like my true dream. Is that actually what I want? Or is it just like this fantasy that's not real? And that the real version of it is like hell on earth, you know?
Well, yeah. So I'm hearing you, and I'm also thinking about what Emily Abt said about wanting to prioritize being a caretaker, right? And then I'm also just thinking about how, you know, I got pregnant and we moved, and my poor son, like, you could tell that it was impacting him. Like, these, what I think, I mean, they're major changes, right? But they're long-term changes. So for me, these are like changes that I think I'll be able to process for the next few years. But he's 4 years old and he's been having these little tantrums that he's never had before. And I'm almost positive it's because of these two major changes. And then you think, like, what if you took your kids on the road? Yeah, there's a disposition that might be able to handle that. And maybe there's homeschooling or whatever, but it's like to be able to anticipate how your kids are going to react to that dramatic of a lifestyle, that seems very tough to figure out. Like, yeah. I know what you're saying. There's like the dream, there's the romance of the travel and the excitement. And then, but I also think it's like, you have no idea what limits of resilience your children have at that age. And they're not going to be able to tell you, right? They're not going to be able to say like, this is disrupting the regulation of my social systems or something, you know, like they're not going to tell you. So like, while I'm sure all these amazing directors and cinematographers who are on the road with kids are figuring it out, I just am witnessing like a minor change happen with major repercussions for us, and it scares me. So I also feel like I'm leaning towards the Emily Abt world of like, yeah, just do what you can with the resources you have right now until you can kind of step back a little bit more when your kids are a little bit older and even more adaptable. So I understand it's like, I like that. What is it? Redesigning your dreams. But I do think that what I'm finding joy in finally is the thing I've been talking about for the past like 2 years, which is like trying to find joy in the process. I'm like finally finding joy in the process. Like, I'm going for these hikes. I created this playlist of music that feels like the music I want in my movie. That was really exciting. It's all like, it's like the girl version of the Mandy score. It's like Susie and the Banshees and Kate Bush and Elastica and like the Breeders. It's not like, I don't know. I don't know if that's a congruent comparison, but it's like this kind of like broody goth indie popishness. And like, that's really fun. Doing the deck is really fun. Doing these like visual inspirations is really fun. And so for me, I think as long as I have one creative escape in addition to being able to support my family, I can make this work for a few, you know, I can make having two kids work. I have faith in that. So hopefully, hopefully that's what we can do, is we can make it work, Auric.
Yeah, make it work. You know, I feel like it's just such a, my life as a director, you know, and I'm sure yours too, it's going to evolve as we have our children and we grow as parents and people. So I'm just not trying to put too much pressure on myself to plan things and to like, you know, like anticipate the future. It's just like, let's just roll with the punches. Like, you know, if there's a movie that I come up with that I write that I love and I'm like ready to go into it again and raise money and go nuts, like, you know, I'll start the process and we'll see how it goes, you know, like, but I'm not going to try to like put, you know, expectations on myself or like set like guidelines or whatever. It's just like, we'll see. Yeah. We'll see where my artistry takes me.
We'll see.
You know?
We'll see. Let it go. Let it go. If you would like to see how you could support us, you could go to patreon.com/MMIH podcast. Anything that you can afford to give to support the show is incredibly beneficial. And we really want to shout out Robert Jones, who was a Patreon supporter at one level, and then he bumped up his support of the show very kind of him. So we're just going to say double happy birthday to Robert Jones for all your support on Patreon. Also, do not forget to check out Jambox.io, who is our sponsor, but they're also a royalty-free music and SFX company with an emphasis on high-quality cinematic cues. Their composers have worked on soundtracks for Hollywood-level films, working with directors like Michael Bay, Martin Scorsese, or global brands like DJI. They offer customized plans to fit your needs, which is awesome. Without any more delay, here is Ulrich and Eric chatting with Checo Varse.
We are here with Checo Varese. Welcome. Thank you so much for being on the show. Give us the elevator pitch for Daisy Jones and the Six.
Making movies is really hard, man. That is the best title for a podcast, and that describes Daisy Jones. Daisy Jones is the story of this bunch of young people that try to find themselves and try to find common love and common passion in life through being a band. And sure, they figure pretty soon that it may or may not happen. And that's the elevated pitch of Daisy Jones. Daisy Jones is the story of grandness and failure, story of drama, it's a story of love, it's a story of humanity, it's a story of human beings trying to love for each other, but sometimes not being able to. Throughout the years together.
And how many days did you roughly shoot?
I shot episodes 1 through 5 and then 7. Mm-hmm. My wonderful colleague Jeff Carter shot episodes 5 to 10 without 7. I shot episodes 1 through 5 as a block, as a one long 5-hour movie.
Wow.
And I believe we shot 12 weeks, whatever, 70 days, 60, 70 days.
Wow.
Something like that. Yeah. That's why I'm saying making movies is hard.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is.
Wow. And then your colleague shot episodes 6 through 10 as another long block, like right after or with a break in between?
There was, the reasoning was to keep the band together and the actor together. So there was a break. There was a natural break. There was Christmas in between. And then I believe there were a couple of weeks that they sort of moved the company to New Orleans where they shot the other 5 episodes or 4 episodes.
Wow.
Yes, there was a break in between, but there was no real break. They continued prepping and organizing and doing everything to get ready for the later episodes in New Orleans. New Orleans just happened to be a location in this. They were in New Orleans because they needed some sort of New York looks and they needed a big stadium, which happened to be available at that time of the year in New Orleans.
Wow, amazing. And I don't know, you probably can't say this, but what was the rough budget of the show? Or do you know roughly the scope of what you were working with?
No, I mean, I could tell you if I knew it. No, let me phrase it in a way that I can say it. I think we had enough resources to make it happen, being careful about the resources. It's always important as a cinematographer. But it was a generous amount of time and a generous amount of resources.
Oh, great. And out of curiosity, so how did you come to the project? I mean, clearly you're very well respected in your field. You're fantastic at what you do. But how did this happen to come across your desk?
Complete serendipity. I was doing a series for Amazon called Them. Mm. The pandemic hit. We had to stop. And this new producer came on board after the pandemic break for whatever reason, for various reasons. There was no philosophical reason that the former team wasn't available anymore after the pandemic. And so this new team took over and we were shooting one episode in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And I remember having coffee with Mike Nelson, the new producer at this point. And we were chatting about the project we were doing. And he said, oh, I have this wonderful project that I'm going to be shooting. And he didn't offer it to me or anything. He just said, it's about this and about that, and it's a rock and roll band of the 70s, and how would you do it? And we talked for like 5 hours on the philosophy of how to shoot period pieces, because period pieces are very complex. Nothing looks period anymore. I'm driving in Vancouver right now. I'm being driven in Vancouver, and everything looks 21st century. You know, the traffic lights, the cars, the things, and everything is 21st century. There's nothing left of 20th century.
Yeah.
And And sort of philosophically, we started talking, and I sort of gave my take on using large format with such and such lenses, so that the shallow focus will be more forgiving with the background and not leaning into visual effects so much due to budget and also due to the fact that, you know, Godzilla is not part of the movie, so you don't have to create a very big 3D character eating people and destroying buildings. So your visual effect... Your visual effects are more related to making the story better, you know. And in the case of Daisy Jones, it's to multiplying audiences. Obviously, you cannot fill up a stadium with 100,000 people. But so one thing led to the other one, and when we finished the coffee, and that was it. And then 3 or 4 months later, he called me out of the blue and said, "Hey, listen, let me send you a script. I think you're the right guy for Daisy Jones." And I had a meeting with the creators. I read the script. They asked me if I wanted to read the book, which is a pretty well-known bestseller. And I said, no, I usually don't want to read the book because then I'll remember the book and I don't remember the script and I start shooting things that are not in the book, in the script, you know, because where is the scene where they love each other? Oh, that's what's in the book, not in the script. So I sort of didn't want to read the book. And I read the script, I did the pitch, and here I am, whatever, a year and a half later, talking to you guys.
Wow. Well, that was my next question. It was like, how long did you spend working on the show? And so it was about a year and a half from when you got, you know, hired on to now.
You know, years, certain age, they all combine with each other.
Especially the last couple of years, they felt like just one giant block. Yeah, I understand.
Exactly. Yeah, the last 4 years. You know, there's a thank God there are political changes in the White House, but maybe I'm wrong. But yeah, it's been a couple of years. Whatever, it was August 2021 when I started, and I finished in May June 2022. My nice. Full time participation. And then, of course, there's post-production and coloring, but it was like an eight, nine-month kind of consecutive engagement.
Nice.
And now, if you could go back and change one thing about it, about the episodes or the production in any way, what would it be?
You know, let me ask you a question. Would you change the title of the podcast?
You know, it's funny, actually. We've talked about it a couple of times. We can add some more things, make it a little more spicy, something like that. But I understand what you're talking about. You're proud of the work you've done, and it is the thing that it is. And I'm
I helped the toddler walk. I saw the toddler going to elementary school, and I saw the toddler going to middle school and high school. And Jeff Cutter, my colleague, took the teenager and took him through college and master degrees. And now it's out there with everyone to watch. I don't know if I would change anything. I wouldn't change anything. It is what it is. And the fellow went to high school and now it's in university, and good luck everyone.
Nice. So I have a very specific question just based off of, you know, what you said about, you know, working on this as a block of episodes. And I saw that you had one director for the first 5 episodes, but then a different director for episode 7. What was that like? Like working with one director for like the majority of it, but then having to switch to somebody new on 7. Did you have to kind of bring them up to speed, or was it a pretty smooth transition? Like, how was that process?
Well, I worked with James Ponsell for the first 5 episodes. So we worked very closely together in designing the look and designing everything that belonged to those episodes. The director of episode 7 is Will Graham. And Will Graham is one of the showrunners.
Oh, nice.
And writer. So he was umbilically attached to the project from the very beginning, and he was an intrinsic part of making it the way it is. So it was a seamless transition. And also, mind you, Will was not directing the block 2. He only directed that one episode. Was participant of all the blocks. So Will and I had long conversations in the flight to Greece and in Greece where we shot episode 7 about episode 7. So I did my own prep with him. So it was almost like shooting a pilot or shooting another movie, another little movie. We prepped and we talked and we embraced the colors and the sun and the sky of Greece in May while everybody else was suffering in New Orleans, a grueling schedule. We were having... You know, we were having octopus and white wine in Greece talking about the philosophical part of how to shoot it. It was great.
You know, when you mention making movies is hard, you're making it sound really, really nice. I'll be honest with you. The white wine makes it sound very appealing. Now, one of the things I have to ask is, now you've worked on some of the biggest studio features. You've worked on huge projects. You've worked on smaller projects. Do you change your process based on the budget size, or does it matter, or does it not matter at all?
Well, first of all, the appetite is always bigger than the plate. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how much. It doesn't matter how much money you have. There is a gentleman or a lady in charge of keeping us in line, and he comes or she comes and says, "Are you out of your mind?" And I'm like, "Yes, yes, that's why you hired me. Of course I'm out of my mind. That's why you hired me." You know, it's never enough, but it's always sufficient. You know, one of the biggest challenges in filmmaking is time. You know, time is, if you do a little independent movie and everybody does it for love or a favor, or it's a short film or it's a documentary, you're the master of your own time. When you're doing a project as large as Daisy, which means, you know, there are five actors, that means there are at least five makeup artists, five hair people, and their triggers and things, and you have to feed all these people. Time is always of essence. So the managing of time is what never changes. You have more time or you have less time, you have more resources, you have less resources. But at the end of the day, you make it do in a very organized way, or try to be organized. And at least in my particular case, the most creative and fun part is it's the actual process of pre-production in which you are creative and you decide the look and you're dreaming about these wonderful things you're going to do. And then reality hits and it's raining and you can only do a close-up in a corner because it's raining. And that is what it gives you the ability to think very quickly and to be creative. And, you know, the troubles in life are the mother of all creativity, or whatever the saying is. You know what I mean?
So when you're on a set, like how much do you take on, like, the feeling of responsibility to get everything done in your day? Like, or are you kind of more like, well, that's not really my job description. Like, if I need more time, I always ask for more time. Or do you try to, like, not push into OT, like, more than, like, once or twice during, like, any given shoot?
Every DP is different, and I can only speak for myself. I try to be very responsible. I try to fit the playground in the sandbox I'm given, you know, and I try to uncover every grain of sand as much as I can in the time given. So I manage the set in a very, my part of the set, of course, is a first AD job and a director job and et cetera, but I manage my part of the set as responsibly as I can, because at the end of the day, it is a restaurant, you know, where the client sits down and wants an appetizer, and 30 seconds later, he wants a second course, and 5 minutes later, he wants a dessert. And those three dishes have to be ready and served in the most beautiful possible way. So, you know, your client comes back for more ceviche or for more bolognese or whatever it is that you're serving, you know.
And just to push you on a follow-up question, like, how often do you tend to go over on these bigger productions? Like, is it a regular habit, or is it something that only happens maybe once or twice, like, across, like, a 12-week shoot?
I wouldn't be talking to you about Daisy Jones if I had the habit to go over. I would be talking about how to shoot weather reports in a little town in with all the respect for Kentucky that has a lot of tornadoes and it's fun to be a weather report person. No.
There you go.
I don't go over. I manage my resources and my time in the most responsible way that I can. And then reality comes in and all of a sudden there was a tornado and you have to wait 3 days. Or there was a COVID case in one of the, which is not the case in Daisy Jones, but in other projects, you know, number one in the coach didn't have COVID, so we all went home for 2 weeks, you know, but that you cannot control.
Yeah.
No, I consider myself a responsible partner, and my craft has to fit the appetite and it has to fit the budget as much as I can. Obviously, believe me, you were my producer. I will push you to the limit of, you know, the rubber band will almost snap, but it hasn't snapped yet.
finding that delicate balance of getting what you need and then also working within your timeline. That's fantastic. I loved an interview that you did for Below the Line where you talked about your choice of camera package and lenses to tell the story for Dope Sick. I was wondering if you could speak to that. Like, what's your choice of technology and the feel that you're going for when it comes to telling a story, and kind of what was that journey on for Daisy?
I'm agnostic when it gets to camera platform. You know, every manufacturer has wonderful cameras. Mm-hmm. Arriflex, Red, Sony, you know, they're all, it's like, you know, it's like a BMW versus an Audi versus a Mercedes. I mean, they all will take you to the next street. You just, it's a choice, you know, and mm-hmm. they're all wonderful cars. In this case, the car ended up being a Venice, a Sony Venice, but it could have been a Mercedes. Oh, sorry, an Arriflex. I'm agnostic on cameras. I think cameras are the brush. Cameras are the canvas. You know, you stretch a canvas or you stretch a piece of wood or you burn a wood to do a lithography. Those are the cameras. And then the brushes and the colors are the lenses. Mm-hmm. You know, you paint with watercolors because you want that look, you know, or you paint with crayons and then burn it so it drips in the wood. And those are the lenses. In the case of Daisy, something very, again, another serendipity happened. When you do a project, you always have a camera test where you test makeup and hair and wardrobe and lenses sometimes. In the case of Daisy, there were five characters, a 15-year-old, well, actually including the interviews, which is sort of the gimmick of the whole project, which is this interviewer that interviewed the character 30 years later or 40 years, 20 years later. So the expanse of time is actually enormous. It's between 61 and 94. It's what the series happened, you know. Mm-hmm. So they ended up having to do like a 6-day camera test for makeup, wardrobe, and hair, because only Daisy, I think she has like 110 wardrobe difference.
Wow. Wardrobe. Oh, man.
You should ask Denise Weingarten, our wonderful costume designer. I think she had like something like that, and everybody else had another plethora of. And then there's the look of her hangover, and the look of her with the hair long and the hair short, and I'm in the shower and after the shower. So that took a long time, and I sort of took advantage of that to go to the camera house that provided the equipment, Kessel Camera, and this is not a commercial, but it is. I went to Kessel Camera and said, okay, so give me one camera for the makeup and hair, give me another one, and let's start testing lenses, manufacturers. And every lens is different, and I shot Dope Sick with one set of lenses, I shot Ben Covenant with another set of lenses. Before that, I shot It Chapter 2 with a completely different set of lenses. So I think changing and using the technology and the beauty of the glass and the lenses for every project, it's crucial. So you have something to say and you honor the project. We ended up, after many days of tests, we ended up choosing a new glass at that point. That was the Ingenieur, the Optimal Prime. We added some internal filter to it, and that's what gives the creamy quality of 1970s to Daisy, along with production design and wardrobe and hair and makeup and color correction, you know, but you start from somewhere, and that was the genesis of it.
So I want to ask a question about some of your other works. You've done, you know, you've been a cinematographer for many years. You've worked on some of the biggest shows, etc. But you also did, you were the B-cam DP on Pacific Rim, like after you'd already shot like episodes of True Blood and Melrose Place and these other big shows. So I'm just curious, like, you know, what was your experience working on Pacific Rim, and how is your process different as the B-cam DP versus the main cinematographer for the whole project?
Pacific Rim was a very specific, in the contract structure of Hollywood and the film industry, if you call it second unit, then you need a second unit director, you know. So Guillermo del Toro wanted to direct every frame of Pacific Rim. So Guillermo Navarro, the DP and longtime collaborator of Guillermo del Toro, called me and said, listen, there's this other unit. It's called, there's not such a thing as a second unit, but so Guillermo will shoot with you between 6 in the morning and 10 and 30 or 12 or whatever, and then he'll come to us and we'll shoot another 5 hours. So Guillermo was bouncing back and forth between two units, directing every frame of it and manipulating every frame of it to his very huge heart and desire and enormous brain. So basically, Pacific Rim had a 90-day schedule, but with a 50-day other unit schedule, ended up having 140 days. I'm just throwing numbers around. I mean, you can quote me on this, but they're numbers I don't know if they're true. But he basically got another big chunk of... So I was the director of photography of that other big chunk, you know, with Guillermo directing. So it had to be called the camera because it wasn't a second unit. It was the other unit. In fact, we were called... We called each other laughing the graveyard unit because we started at 4 in the morning and we were run by 3 p.m. You know what I mean?
Wow. And what kind of stuff were you shooting? Was it all like the stuff without actors, like just, you know, the establishing shots or the robots or?
No. Everything, if you recall, Pacific Rim had these big robots that were controlled by two or three or four characters inside the head of the robot, fighting monsters that came from somewhere. And those robots had, the head was where they controlled it. So we were mainly doing all the actors inside this set that looked like the robot head.
Oh, wow.
We was a big gimbal. And when I say a big gimbal, imagine you put in your house in, you know, Laurel Canyon on top of a platform that moves. That's exactly what we were shooting. Like a huge set on a gimbal that was, imagine the head of a robot bobbing left and right. You know, that's what we shot.
Wow, crazy.
That's nuts. I wanted to talk to you a bit about It Too and kind of what that process was like, because you're coming into the sequel. So you kind of already have a bit of the table set for you, if you will. Why were you brought in for the sequel? Was there a switch with the DP for any specific reason?
No, I think what happened with the chapter two is very interesting. I've known Andy and Barbara for a long time. Andy Muschietti, the director, and Barbara Muschietti, the producer. We crossed paths. We both speak Spanish and like soccer, you know. So
the essentials, yes, of course.
Of course. I mean, I'm sorry, it's not essential. It's crucial. So we crossed paths right before chapter two. We shot a pilot. I can't remember what it was. And then they offered me chapter two. I read the script. And it was a sequel, but it wasn't a sequel because it's about these characters that are, whatever, 15, 20 years later. So I was able to imprint the quote-unquote contemporary part of the look through my vision and yet respecting my predecessor, VP Chung, and paying homage to his choices when we were refilming or filming again or adding to the flashback. So I had to sort of replicate or pay homage to a look that existed, but I also could imprint my own look for the future part, which is when the characters are 30 or 40 or 25. Sure. So it was a sequel, but with its own personality. So that I found very attractive, you know?
Mm-hmm. So when you're working on a project like that, that's like an existing property that has like hundreds and thousands of fans, and there's like a lot of anticipation leading up to the release of the movie. Do you feel any of that kind of pressure to like do justice to the original or to the characters, or do you just zero in on the specific story and just focus on that?
I would lie if I say that there was no pressure. I would lie if I would say that I wasn't waking up at 4 in the morning sweating, saying, oh my God, what did I put myself into? But then again, you can only look forward. You know, there is this forward movement that you have to apply to your creative process and cross your fingers and hope for the best. I think we did really well. I think the movie stands in his own feet and pays homage to the fans in a way that everybody, but that is also the director, you know, the director it imprints his own fingerprint, repeating myself. Jeff Help, the director, puts his own patina and his own thoughts and his own soul in it. And I'm just the one that helps, grabbing him or her by the shoulders and trying to help going through the snowstorm that is doing a movie. You know, I always compare doing a movie to, I always say I was never hired to be a submarine captain. You know, you go, you take your crew, you log yourself in a nuclear submarine for 3 months and you come up for air, and it's like, oh my God, they invented cell phones while I was, you know, doing something else. What happened? Oh my God, there is a cell phone 15 and I still have a cell phone 8. You know what I mean? So it's like being a submarine captain. You disappear from the world. You try to stay in touch with your family and your loved ones and my daughter and my wife. But everything else comes secondary. I mean, it's so funny. A film said it's all about what you're doing in the moment, you know. And then sometimes you talk about climate change, but not that much. And as soon as you finish the project, you get depressed because there's this thing called climate change.
Yeah. Well, I think we're ready to jump to our final six questions. Ulrich, do you have any other questions?
I can't help it. I have one last little one that just sparked from what you just said. Like, how do you manage spending time with your family when you work on something like Daisy Jones? Do they come with you? Do you fly back to see them when you can? Like, how does that work?
Well, there is an advantage. I'm married to an extraordinary Italian director, Patricia Riggins. So we try to work together as much as we can, and it becomes a family affair. And we become the Green Bean Brothers circle that goes to the next town, and we put up a tent and we all live together there with the lions and the zebras and cleaning the manure every morning and then clapping at every show. There is a sense of understanding that comes from both sharing the same profession. There is some sacrosanct things that you have to do. You know, you have to go on Zoom or phone or take the first flight out and come back the next day. I remember, you know, doing a show in New York and literally commuting every Friday and coming back every Sunday, you know. So you are in the little ballet class and you take the garbage out of home and change a couple of bolts and hug your wife, hug your daughter, and go into the American Airlines flight back to, like, the submarine. You try to manage that. And there's a very little sleep involved, I have to say.
Oh, boy.
I would imagine. It sounds like you're just up for 20 hours a day.
Yeah. I shot until 4 in the morning yesterday. I woke up at 10, and I'm here I am trying to make sense after 4 coffees. Not to sound like an exhausted guy that is about to walk literally in the rain to shoot a scene, because in Vancouver, there is a tendency in this part of the world to rain constantly, I would say.
Yeah.
Wow. It has rained the last 35 days. Yeah.
Yeah, Canada does that. They really like the rain and the snow.
Yeah, unless they take a plane and go to Mexico. Yeah, which happens a lot.
Well, I'd say, let's get our last questions out of the way here so we can let you go on with the rest of your day. And I'm assuming 4 more coffees.
Oh, there's a camera system waiting. At the end of this car ride, there's a camera system with an extended hand in the coffee. Yes, for sure.
That is a good assistant right there. Thank you, camera assistant, for the coffee. All right, our last 6 questions. First one, what is the first film you ever shot and how do you feel about it now? And that can be like a school project or something you did just like, you know, in your backyard when you were a kid or something like that.
I started as a news camera. That's a question I don't know how to answer. I was an architect, and finished architecture, and there was nothing being built in the country of origin, Peru. And somebody said, hey, National Geographic needs a driver that knows a little bit of camera work in the highlands of Peru. And I said, yes. So I went there, and I ended up, after 3 days, saying, this is the last thing I'll ever do in my life, and I'll become a filmmaker. And that was 1984, with a documentary about the Amazon jungle or the highlands of Peru or something like that. So that was my first experience.
And what's the best filmmaking advice you've ever received?
I was a news cameraman. I mean, it's probably not the best, but it's the one I remember because I told the anecdote yesterday. I was a cameraman in El Salvador. I was a war correspondent I was a freelance, so the producer was this crusty old experienced more than old gentleman. And I remember I came back and I said, he asked me, what do you have? Well, I have the shot of the flag and the president talking, and you know, the police came, and after 10 minutes there is this woman crying and blah blah blah. Okay, great. So then my colleague, a colleague came, and he asked him, what do you got? And he goes, well, you know, when we got there, the taxi took a wrong turn and we ended up in the wrong place and the batteries were not charged, so I didn't got anything. And the guy immediately, without even thinking, said, I cannot broadcast excuses. You're fired.
Wow.
Whoa.
And that to me was, holy moly, okay, I gotta be on my toes with or without coffee. It doesn't matter. So that haunts me for 34 years. They're not excuses. We have to do what we have to do at the time allotted, and it is what it is.
Huh.
Nice.
Conversely, then, what is the worst filmmaking advice that you've ever gotten?
Oh, if you do good, you'll get an Oscar.
Okay. All right.
There are 3,000 projects or 30,000 projects done every year. Your goal is not an Oscar. Your goal is to do the best project you can, because there is only one Oscar a year. Hmm.
Do you have a goal as a cinematographer?
An Oscar. No. I consider myself the first audience of every project. What I see, you haven't seen. When I saw Daisy Jones, you haven't seen it. So I consider myself the first audience. So I have to put myself in the shoes of that audience that is watching it in a theater or in his or her home, and hopefully not on his iPhone watch, but it's watching this project and enjoying this project. So I have to pay homage and respect to the people that are watching it, and I have to be surprised, and I have to cry, and I have to be scared, and I have to laugh. And if I don't cry, if I don't laugh, and I don't get scared, you won't get scared. Mm. I put myself in your shoes as much as I can.
Wow.
If you could go back in time, what is one piece of advice that you would give to yourself?
Do the same I did.
Oh, okay. Nice.
I wouldn't be able to change my career, because this is who I am, and I became who I am because of my circumstances. So I cannot change that. But I can give you advice, and I can give everybody else advice, which is, don't even think about, and because this is a podcast, I'm going to put a beep in there. Don't even beep think about doing what I did, because I think it's the wrong path. You know, it took me a long time and a lot of suffering, but I wouldn't be able to change anything, because, and not because I'm not self-critic. I mean, I'm the most self-critic person I can be with myself, and I'm the hardest person I can be with myself, but I don't know how to change things that happen, you know. You can only change future. You cannot change history. You have to learn from history, and you have to, so you can change the future.
And last question, is making movies hard?
Making movies is extraordinarily hard. Maybe that's the new title of the podcast. It's an enterprise that requires, to begin with, a miracle. Requires a script. Requires an actor that is available and willing. Requires a crew that it's standing under the rain for hours and hours. Requires a producer that finds the finances. Requires an editor that puts it together. Requires, I don't know, 300 people to make it work as a machine, as a clock that it's done with love and precision, but at the same time open to interpretation. Is one of the most difficult business or difficult enterprises there is. And I'm talking about your little short film with your three friends in somebody's house to, you know, the Titanic sinks. You know, it's as difficult. But I wouldn't change it. You know, I don't know how to do anything else. Well, actually, I'm a better cook than cinematographer, so one day I'll open a restaurant. But I wouldn't change much.
If you are a better cook than cinematographer, then I am going to be the first person to line up to go to your restaurant.
Well, when my wife always laughs and says, we should do this little side business called Rent-A-Chef. You know, so I go to your house with all my things, and I cook in your house, and I tell you about how to not to make mistakes in movies.
Oh, you're hired.
Making movies. Making movies. I compare DPs, and there's a long answer. So Jeff, help me. You can edit it. Making movies. Being a cinematographer is like being a chef. We all go to the same supermarket, and we buy the same tomatoes, and we buy the same meat, and the olive oil comes from more or less the same region, and we have a stove that is gas, and we have a frying pan that is copper or whatever it is. You take these 7 ingredients and you give it to 7 different chefs, and we'll do 7 different dishes, because what they bring is what they have in their hearts, in the story, in their knowledge. VPs are the same. We always rent the same cameras. We rent the same lights, and the trucks are the same. And you know, the film used to be the same. It was all Kodak or Fuji. Every movie is different because we bring our own history to it, our own background, and our own understanding of the world. And that's what it makes us chefs of our own images.
That's beautiful, by the way. And last question, where should people go if they want to learn more about you? Where should they go if they want to watch Daisy Jones and the Six? Sell the wares, you know, tell us about your stuff.
Daisy Jones and the Six is in Amazon Prime. If you have Amazon Prime, if not, it's probably all over the place now. Hopefully not pirated yet, but it will be. and to learn more about me. I don't know if you want to do that. Stay away from a coffee drinking Peruvian Italian DP that runs around the world in a submarine. My next project is with my wife. I'm in Vancouver shooting a wonderful project called Under the Bridge. I don't know if I can tell you more about that.
Nice.
And my next project, it's a movie with my wife in South Africa, which we literally leave.
Wow.
I arrived to LA Wednesday and I leave on Monday to South Africa.
Wow.
And it's a project for Patricia Regan. So that's the love of my life. And the project will be the second love of my life.
Ulrich, what do you remember about your and Eric's talk with Checo?
I already talked about it a little bit, but I mean, just this man has like so much, like filmmaking is just so much embedded into his life, you know, and the way that he talks about his craft was really exciting, you know, and really fun to like hear the way that he approaches the cinematography for a show or a movie. The thing that really, I'm a nerd big time, and I'm a big Guillermo del Toro fan. Like I'm, you know, wouldn't say I'm a humongous Pacific Rim fan, but I really enjoyed Pacific Rim a lot. Like I thought it was a really fun movie. I've seen it a few times, but just to hear how that movie was made and his part in that movie, where he was basically like one half of the cinematographer, you know, but like just because like there's no co-cinematographers, you can't really, there's no credit that way, you know, in the industry. Like he had to be like, you know, whatever it is, like B-cam DP, I think is his title. But like, just for you, Liz, the way that they did this was like, you know, Guillermo del Toro didn't want a second unit because he wanted to direct every single frame of the movie himself because he's crazy. And so they had two crews going in on almost the whole time. So like they would start at 3 a.m. Checo's unit, and they would be working on all the stuff inside the heads. So not just like, you know, wide shots and action, but like all the actor stuff that happens in the heads. Mm. And so Guillermo del Toro would start at like 5 or 6 a.m., shoot with them for 5 or 6 hours, and then go to the other unit and then shoot like other scenes with other actors for 5 or 6 hours and like just do that. So it was like basically like the team would be like running all day, you know, these two different teams, like basically working like, I don't know, 20 hours or something across both teams. But then he would actually get to shoot for like 5 to 6 hours with each team with no waiting because all the prep had already been done while he's shooting other scenes. Sounds madness, dude. Sounds like total madness.
Well, I just remember that I was a film critic when Pacific Rim came out, and so was Sean, my husband. And he hated it, and the internet hated him for hating Pacific Rim. So it's like one of those inside jokes in our like relationship is like, you don't bring up that and Cabin in the Woods. Sean hates Cabin. It's like,
oh man, those are two movies that like the internet and critics like, yeah, like surrounded and like pushed up as like these special amazing movies that like can do no wrong and they're so perfect, incredible. And I don't hate those movies, but like I definitely am sort of like overhyped maybe a little.
Fair. I loved Cabin in the Woods, so like I get in my little tiff with Sean, but he's like Scream was better. You know, like they had Scream was smarter about, like, he just go, whatever, this is not the Sean show, but he's a horror purist, and so we got angry at Cabin in the Woods.
Well, Scream's great. How can you not love Scream?
It's so good. But Ulrich, I have a question for the game. Can you do it? Do
the
you want to try it?
Game. Okay. We are here to play the game.
The game. For those who are not initiated, or unless you want to do this intro, I'm just going to keep going, is a game that we play where our producer Eric Toms gives one of us an indie film quandary, a challenge to behold in our hands and to pick apart and parse from our own perspective. So I have not read this question, and Ulrich has not read this question or heard this question, and he's going to answer it. So Eric Tom's question is, you've been grinding in the entertainment industry for over a decade. You've made multiple projects for free or at a deficit so as to create a body of work to exhibit. You've picked up jobs here and there, but they've all paled in comparison to the career you've yearned for. This just is like, state the truth, Eric. Okay, finally, after years of toil, you've hit upon something that has really struck a chord with your audience, and the industry has sat up and take notice of you. You're finally starting to be offered the kinds of jobs you've always dreamed of, but there's just one problem. You're exhausted. After years of hard work, you've hit a wall creatively, emotionally, and physically. You're having a hard time focusing or even caring about the work you're doing. The big project is all set to start very shortly, and you're sure that if you take a break now, that there's a real chance that this opportunity will pass you by. Do you, A, push through this one job and hope that you can take a break after it's wrapped? B, let your agents, managers, and executives know that you need a mental break and deal with the possible fallout? C, that's it. You just get A and B to choose from. Or D, other.
Wait. So I've been working for how many years without a break?
Over a decade.
I mean, over he's a decade just, without a break.
No, he's basically describing our situations and every indie filmmaker out there. He's saying, you've been working volunteer labor as a filmmaker for over 10 years, which I would say describes me. I don't know if it describes you.
Yeah.
But you have finally hit a big break, but you're exhausted.
Oh, no. What do you mean? If you finally hit your big break, of course you go for it. There's no, what do you mean? I mean, I guess I think I wanted more details in what he means. Cause like, you know, if you're describing our lives as like people who are hustling and trying to make movies, you know, and like, I don't know. Do you not take vacations ever? You take vacations sometimes.
No, I don't take vacations. Or no.
You never take vacations.
No.
Okay. Just like going to see family on the holidays is like the vacation.
We don't really have a budget for vacations, we've never taken a vacation.
Never taken a vacation. No. Oh my God. My last vacation was probably in 2016, maybe, or something like that.
That's like almost effectively not taking a vacation, you know?
but it was also, it was a shoot. So like, yeah, we got so to go to Italy for a shoot, but then we like spent some time, you know, it was like we went to Italy for the shoot, but then I brought my wife and we got to like hang out in Italy like for like 4 or 5 days, you know? So it was a vacation, you know, but there was some work involved too. So I don't know if that counts or not.
I mean,
but
I think that the world of like a pure vacation, who does that? I guess people who have fancy jobs, they can like take a week off and turn off their email. That's very confusing to me. But let's recognize you're not doing that.
Probably going to do that when your kids are older and like it's spring break. Like you're like every parent I know who has kids that are over 4
takes vacation.
Spring break.
When you're spring with your kids, you're working. That's not a vacation. What I'm talking about, like an actual vacation. I've never had a vacation.
I think your definition of vacation and my definition are very different.
The true definition should be a point where you relax. When have you ever relaxed?
Well, if I can be relaxing with my family, like, you know, no. That's no.
what are you talking about? You're relaxing with your family? That is something that you do?
Yeah, me and her, we hang out and we just, you know, we'll like play around or like then she's like watching a movie and we're just like chilling together.
But you're not constantly worried about the like the looming feeling and foreboding sense of death around them at every turn and then worried about them falling or getting decapitated. You're not worried about these things all the time.
Not anymore. I was worried about that when she was super young, but like now, like I just throw up in the air like she's like a bag of chips and catch her and whatever and all you know.
So we.
I'm obviously concerned that I don't drop her.
You can relax. You're allowed. You are able to figure out how to relax still.
Yes.
Okay. That sounds nice. All right.
But yeah, I think for this question, like, you know, yeah, I think like of course you go for it. Like unless he's meaning like you've been working on another movie for like 6 months and then that movie finally finished and now you have your big break. And then it's like you don't get any break. You just go into another movie for 6 months. I think that would be kind of harder, you know, but if that's not like as specific as he's getting, yeah, I guess I just go for it, you know, like, of course, if it's your big break, that's like what you've been working so hard for so long, like you're not going to not go for it.
Yeah.
Right. Am I missing something to this question?
I love that both of us just spend 20 minutes deconstructing the question sometimes. And it's not really 20 minutes. It's like 2 seconds. But like sometimes we need Eric to be a part of the show to be like to answer questions for us about the premise.
Right.
No, I'm with you. And I think you and I have just proved proved that there are gradients of mental health that you can integrate into your life. Clearly, I need to integrate more into my life. I took a 10-minute nap today, and it like was very rare, and it's thrown me off. Like, I'm more anxious having taken that 10-minute nap. And I'm going to have to deal with it for the next 6 hours. So I agree. I think you push forward, but then you figure out, like, maybe you up your therapy time, or you up your, you know, you take something off your plate. You do something to protect your week, or to give yourself you time, or you don't participate in one aspect that they want you to participate in. I think it's like, because I think what Eric's implying is like, you shouldn't ignore the words that he's saying. You're exhausted and you're near a breaking point, right? So that means you have to do something. You have to do something for yourself at that point. But I agree, like, there's opportunities are so rare in this industry. I would probably also, yes, push forward and just try to figure it out somehow.
Yeah. I feel like if you're near a breaking point, yeah, I don't know. I feel like that's sometimes I see that where like people have like worked really hard on movies or building up a body of work or whatever. And like they're at the stage where they could push themselves to the next level and then they quit, you know?
Yeah.
And I feel like that's kind of natural that like, you know, I can't remember the reference, but they were talking about like, you know, usually when you feel like you're so far away and then you're like, you know, pushing, and you've been pushing so far, you'll never get there. And then there's like, imagine you're in a tunnel.
That's Milan Chakraborty. It's his.
Oh, that's what Milan.
Okay. That he always shares. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's like, you don't know where the other end of the tunnel is, but like, yeah, maybe it's like one more hit away.
Yeah.
It's like, so I think if that came to my lap, it'd be like, that's the hit. You gotta go through it, you know? And then like maybe just try to like build in some downtime, like, you know, 2 months or a month or something after where you don't have to do anything. You just like make that work with the finances that you have and like whatever the deal that you're getting, just make sure you're getting enough money, you know, in this deal that's the big break, that you can have some downtime, you know, with you and your family afterwards.
Well, I think the assumption is that you would be treated like a workhorse for the rest of your life, right? Like you would become
Chico Varcé, basically, yes, is what you're saying.
Good job, Eric, thematically tying this game into the interview.
No, that was good. That was very good. Yeah, no, I mean, but I see his point, but I think like as long as like if it is the big break,
yeah,
like you can protect yourself, you know? And if it means missing out on the next big thing, well, just know that there's another big thing coming, right? So like I would take the one that you got the bird in the hand or whatever they say, take that and then, you know, then take some time. That's what I would do.
And I would say like our conversation with Emily Apt, which won't be coming up for a few weeks, but you can have your big break and then you could have another break 14 years later, right? Like it may feel like that it's, you may get impatient or you may get scared or whatever. But if you are talented and you persevere, and also I would say, let's not be reliant on the system to provide the quote unquote break for us, right?
Right.
Like you can create your own content and you can create your own opportunity, even if you can't participate in the way the system makes content.
I like that. Everybody else, do you agree? Do you disagree? If you want to weigh in on this or send us another game suggestion, you can write us at podcast@makingmoviesishard.com. Or if you really like the show, you can leave us a review on iTunes. We've gotten a couple of those lately, which feels great. But the more the merrier, of course. You can also check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at MMIH Podcast and YouTube at Making Movies is Hard Podcast. Make sure to check out the International Screenwriters Association, the ISA. They're an organization designed to connect writers with filmmakers through a number of programs they offer, including publishing your logline to a network of industry professionals, consultation courses, contests, and their top 25 writers list featuring some of their best writers. So head over to www.networkisa.org to sign up for free today. Thanks to Chico Varcé for coming on the show. Schlellinger? Close enough. Thanks to Holden Schlanger from Emmanuel Bates Communications for setting this whole thing up and making this happen after like 3 weeks of like having to push it back. Finally got it in the can. Thanks to our editor, Jeff Reimuth, for doing the editing. And thanks to our producer, Eric Toms, for just being awesome. Thank you all for listening. And we'll talk to you next week or on Thursday.
This week week, we welcome cinematographer Checo Varce to talk about his work on the new Amazon show. It's Apple.
I think it's Amazon.
Is it Amazon?
Double check.
Oh my God, you're probably right. This is what happens when I don't sleep, Jeff. My brain is very confused.